Joel Cohen typified a lot of the problems with the biological sciences by saying in science that they suffered from physics envy. And I think we can see from the last two talks, and I'm sure we will see from David Rinlinger's final talk, that that doesn't characterize mathematics and the mathematical sciences as we end the century. David Rinlinger is very distinguished in many ways. One of the ways in which he's distinguished is that he is one of the best friends that Canadian mathematics and statistics has in the United States. He's an ex, or let's say presently living in Canada South, Canadian. He's one of the non-resident fellows of the Royal Society of Canada. He's been gracious enough to work very hard for Canadian mathematics, Canadian statistics on the within NSERC. And I think he typifies also all of the sorts of things that Kathy and Nassif and others have talked about earlier during the day, and to try to breach this delicate blend of application, of exposition, of research that's worthy in its own right. And in, on all those grounds, it's a pleasure to invite him to give the final talk of the afternoon.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. There's a quote which people have ascribed to Margaret Atwood in some context, of someone that they're as Canadian as possible, considering the circumstances. I've got that on my homepage. I was also honored to be invited when the Fields Institute opened at Waterloo. That's where its first site was. And there I was introduced as a Leafs fan. And people stared in amazement, I guess because you don't see a lot of Leafs fans. So anyone who wants to talk to a Leafs fan can find me at the reception afterwards. Well, I've been collaborating with a marine biologist from Hub SeaWorld, which is down in San Diego, on studying the trajectories of elephant seals as they're taking migrations and so on. And I wanted to begin with a couple of pictures of these fellows. My collaborator asked that I assure everyone that these are not alive. These are not dead. These fellows here are quite alive. And they're very active in many respects. And so we can say they swim, they forage, they breed, migrate, molt, sleep, they fight. That the picture I just took off was a bit of that. My collaborator says they're not of this earth. And it seems that as people learn things about them, this seems a truer and truer statement. Around the turn of the century, there may possibly have only been 60 to 80 of these elephant seals left on the earth. And the Mexican government protected the island they were on down in the Sea of Cortez, and they were protected along the United States coast also, and now they've grown to almost 150,000 of them. They're absolutely massive. The females are 600 to 800 kilograms. The males can be 2,300 kilograms. The males can be 6 meters long. So they very definitely have a presence. And actually, in a bit, I will be showing some pictures of them putting the sensor on to collect the data. And my collaborator, Brent Stewart is his name, he says, "We just let them do what they want." They look for a time when they're sleeping, and we'll give them a hypodermic to make them sleep a bit longer, and that's when they'll put on the sensor. One of the surprises is that they migrate twice a year, not just the usual once, and they can travel up to 12,000 kilometers on some of their journeys. They are submerged near most of the time, 90% of the time. We'll see that, for example, they're submerged for 20 minutes and then they're on the surface for 2 minutes. They are mammals. They do require some air for breathing. They can dive for up to 1,600 meters. All these things have just been emerging the last few years as they've been putting the sensors on them to collect the information. And they can dive for up to 2 hours. And basically, these are things that are living at 600 meters. In terms of where they travel to, This graph here is sometimes known as the free range by people who study wildlife. They are along the coast breeding here, and this not hatched area is sort of the breeding range. They go off on these migrations, and the female journeys take them into this sort of strip here, whereas the males come right along the coast and are up here. Also, they're journeying down there. Now, there is a Canadian presence going along with these, and anyone who's ever heard me talk about anything, I think, will know that I always start out by trying to find a Canadian presence in the topic that I'm concerned with. So the Nootkas, specifically the Maka, hunted the elephant seals along the Strait of Juan de Fuca. They had a name for them. I don't know how to speak Nootka. Likwasi, one who hunches his shoulders or one who pulls his head in. And so basically they're all gone, but they've recently started hauling out on race rocks on the island here. So they're returning to having a presence along the west coast. Now, I'm just going to put this graph up pretty quickly because it's a very clever idea my collaborator had for displaying the data. What we have here, females and males, going out from the center of this circle, we have the depth of a dive. So each dot refers to a dive, and the distance out refers to the maximum depth of that dive. Going around the outside here, we have the months of the year. And so basically, in this period here, they're going to be down off Santa Barbara or near Santa Cruz in Año Nuevo, breeding in this period here, this part of the year. Then they are off diving into different depths, and then they come back to their origin, and they're molting there. This is an American slide, that's why there's no U. We have the other dives there. You know, I always have to remind myself, David, be sure to say Z, because if I come out with a Z, all my friends in Toronto are really on top of me about it. And then the males, we see they are spending a longer time in the breeding part of the year, and they're molting over there. Now, it's very easy to appear to be a very profound statistician. And I actually, if you ever find yourself in the context of wanting to pretend you are a very profound statistician, remember what I'm about to say. You get invited to some meeting, and people are discussing and arguing and so on, and you let them do that for maybe 10 minutes, and then you say, but what is the question? Then you let them argue and fight and so on and discuss for another 10 minutes, and then you say, but what is the question? And actually, it's a bit like being a therapist, I guess, because somehow progress is made when you simply sit there and say, but what is the question? Okay, so I was after my friend Brent about what was the question that was involved. Now, I should own up and say the reason I got involved with this is the way too often a statistician gets involved. The marine biologists had been collecting all this data for 10 years, and they didn't know what to do with it. They're just being overwhelmed, and you'll see how big some of the data sets are in just a moment. So some of the questions they've been concerned with are, how to describe the movements, and movement, by that I mean migration, when they go off on these long journeys. How to describe dives and bouts of dives. Brent wanted to know if I was going to pronounce bout like a Canadian pronounces bout. I don't know whether I did, but I'm on the West Coast, and that accent's not quite so strong out here. Another issue is comparative questions, differences between male and female, differences between age groups, things of that sort. Another thing is picking up the long-term nature of the behavior. You will see that a lot of the measurements are made every 30 seconds, so long-term refers to things over a month. Another question of interest is understanding the 24-hour period, is there an approximate 24-hour period in their behavior, and how does it behave? So that's a bit of the marine biology part. Now, I guess I've actually started the statistics part already, but here's a quote of a Montrealer that I've always liked. In earlier times, they had no statistics, and so they had to fall back on lies.
Hence the huge exaggerations of primitive literature. Giants are miracles or wonders. They did it with lies, and we do it with statistics. But it's all the same. These sea elephants, for sure, are giants in their area. And another definition of statistics. A lot of numbers looking for an argument. I wonder if anyone here knows the collective noun for a group of statisticians. A quarrel. And that's and ask any three statisticians, get four opinions. So I could presumably just continue the rest of the talk with that sort of stuff. I had a passport photo taken, and I'm just sitting there trying to look neat for a change, and the photographer found out I was a statistician, and he was from India. He said, in my country, we have a saying, statistics don't lie, and they don't sit well either. Okay. Well, let's try to be serious for a bit. I guess the advantage of a talk at 5:30 is you can be or not, or you don't have to be serious, depending upon the feeling. Okay, a more professional definition, let's say that, of statistics would be a collection of tools and philosophies for the analysis of data. And you'll find that statisticians have a variety of tools that they use to be working with data and so on. I will be focusing more on stochastic models, which are part of probability theory, and in many situations, a statistician, when he's given a situation, he will strive to build some sort of model for that situation. And that's just made me remember a wonderful quote of George Box, where he said once that the statistician, unlike Pygmalion, must not fall in love with his model. But the models, if you want, you can view as being mathematical models. We make immense use of computers, and they're now very nice packages that of higher level packages one can use for doing the analysis of data and so on. I would say in my work I use equal doses of substantive knowledge going along with the particular field the data comes from and mathematics. Fisher has said that statistics was applied mathematics, and that's certainly the way I view it. And just definition of a stochastic model, probabilistic description of a circumstance. Okay. Now, I'm going to be concerned with these seals as they are migrating. So the part of mathematics, really, of probability theory that's pertinent is that of stochastic processes, which refers to random curves. Random walk would be the origin of a lot of the techniques. Basically, there's a particle moving along, and in our case, this particle is a pretty big one of these elephant seals. And so basically, stochastic processes are used to describe trajectories. And that's where a lot of the stochastic process material came from in the early terminology. They talked about them as trajectories, random trajectories in the early days. So to give an example, 1828, Brown was concerned with particles suspended in some sort of fluid and saw they were moving around a lot in an apparent random fashion. And he basically had a description of it. And then Einstein and later researchers came up with formal descriptions of the movement. And the equation that was set down in those early, at the early part of the century, was this Langevin equation, where ut is representing the velocity of something in three-dimensional space, so it's got three components. The change in the velocity, one imagines, as being proportionate to the velocity it's moving at. That's the friction term. And then there's some random element that's added on there. The Brownian motion case, one wouldn't have this friction term in there. This is an example of a stochastic differential equation. And you'll see in my work with the elephant seals, I'm driving myself towards getting such a description of their motion. Now, it turns out these elephant seals go so far that actually it makes sense to model them as a particle moving on the surface of a sphere. Now, there was some work done by Perrin in 1928 for the case of a Brownian particle in a sphere. He had a model of one of these things being buffeted with sort of, let's say, a blemish on the surface, and you saw this blemish rotating around. And so he set down some of
the fundamental results. Both Perrin and Einstein got Nobel Prizes, so obviously this is something that's an area that's worth working on. So now I want to switch to the data that's involved. So here we see a long-suffering elephant seal. I hope you can see the look on this poor fellow's face here. So he's obviously been sedated. This is the fellow I work with, Brent, and he's I don't know, a couple of inches shorter than me. I don't know. You have to be pretty macho to work with these animals, Brent told me once. So here he is being macho. And basically what they're doing is they're gluing, using epoxy to fasten onto the back of this fellow one of their recorders. And here is a fellow. It's not some vandal, some graffiti artist who's written on this guy. It's like this. Better. The scientists have all have done this writing. And these guys molt in a very dramatic fashion. They lose all the hair and all sorts of skin. So that writing will be gone at the end of the season now. Right here is the sensor. Yeah, it does turn up pretty well. That's good. So basically, they've epoxied this time depth recorder onto the seal, and it monitors a number of things. They're going to be gone for 3 or 4 months, and so it can only record so much. There's only so much memory in it, and so on. And the principal things it's recording are depth, light level, and it's a digital recorder. Now, one of the things that surprised me a lot when I became involved with this was that the way they estimated the position of the seal. And it turned out, and this is something that Brent and his collaborator worked out, that they had this light meter, and from the time of sunrise and sunset, they're able to get an estimate of the latitude, and from the time of midday, they're able to get an estimate of the longitude. Now, I was partly, I think, very impressed by this because actually I'd learned navigation, and I'd actually won a prize not far from here when I was pretty young. And when my mother died, I brought back a trunk of old photos home, and I found one from those days. Basically, this is David. I was in the Canadian Navy when I was at university, and I spent a wonderful summer at Esquimalt, just down the road. And this it's sort of even more ironic, this picture. This is the HMC of St. Teresa. This is Santa Barbara in the background here in this photo, and this is where the seals are starting from. So, having this latitude and longitude to work with was brought back all these memories. Now, here's an example of one of the seals. So, we started out they start out here in this island of Santa Barbara, and it's a female. She's headed off in this particular fashion here, and to prove that sort of this geometry of spheres is necessary. Here I'm just dropping on top of it the great circle route that goes along with this. So the sort of question someone in the audience is going to ask me is, how do they know how to navigate? And I tell you my answer is going to be indeed. But somehow they do seem to be able to follow this coast. Now, up here we have Victoria, where we are now. The computer package I was using didn't have Canada in it, so I had to listen. It gets worse. It didn't have Canada in it. So what I did was I got out our atlas and read off the latitude and longitude of Victoria. And when I plotted the position first, it was over here. So talk about American imperialism and things like that. But that was because I typed in a number in it, inappropriately. Okay, so then we have this data, and it's basically midday positions. And one wants to fit a mathematical model to that, and the model has to have some sort of irregular component in it to handle the fact that they're racing off foraging and so on.
Now, when I was at Esquimalt, the sort of thing I learned was, suppose you were at this position here and you wanted to get this to this position over here, what was the course you had to steer and what was the distance? That's just setting up some notation. And here we find the formulas that go along with this. At the top, we have this unanswerable question, so please don't ask it. But a more question one can grab onto with more confidence is the question of, are they following great circles? So we have a number of these things, and they certainly aren't all following great circles, but the one I showed you was like the second and third one that I studied. So this is the sort of thing one used to learn out at Esquimalt. And so eta here is the great circle course, and rho is the distance. To get the course, you basically find the distance, and then you are getting the course itself from there. So we find ourselves then in a situation where we have data. So we have latitudes and longitudes for one of these animals as they're heading off. And one would like to have some sort of statistical description that goes along with that. Now, I've already referred to Perrin. So he was concerned with a particle just moving randomly on the sphere. But the difference in this case is that the seals seem to have a target that they're heading off to. It's in the target when they're going is more an area where they're going to hang out for a while. On the way back, though, they're definitely heading back to the island for breeding and so on. So we have to include an additional term in our representation here, a drift term. And so we can picture saying that they're going to be moving with a certain velocity. Let's call it delta towards the target. Okay, so here's the representation I've been working with for this path, describing this trajectory. So theta and phi, theta's the co-latitude, so it's the distance from the location up to the North Pole, 90 degrees minus the latitude. Phi's the longitude, and we have here a two-dimensional stochastic differential equation. And it's sort of always fun to be doing statistics because it just seems as soon as there's a question that has any sort of teeth in it, you find yourself in an area that no one has worked in before. And so I've asked a number of people, what do they know about two-dimensional Brownians with drift on the sphere? And not very much, it turns out. And so here is the set of equations whose properties I've been developing. And we have here the co-latitude and so on, and this sort of, these terms are appearing because of the fact that as you get nearer to the pole, the distances aren't the same, and you have to be compensating for that. The UT and the VT here, these are random Gaussian processes, Brownian motions, naive Brownian motions, and the sigma is representing the variability. So the sigma, in some sense, refers to how much the foraging the animals is doing is taking them away from the from the basic path. Now, it seems to be the case that when you've got on top of a problem, you're able to simulate processes that fit in with the sort of data that you have. And so that model I showed you just there, here is a realization of it. So there is a point over here that I had in mind that the seal was heading to that I picked up from an existing path. And it's sort of fun that this process has the behavior of that sort of goes along with them. See, what's going on is at each point, each time one imagines the seal is heading straight towards this point here and tries to get there but gets deflected around by chasing squid and things like that. Okay, suppose that the seal has actually got to this point. Well, it keeps trying to head there. And it goes zooming past and so on in the time interval. So this is representative of the foraging. And coming back, one would have to have a different sort of model that actually has it stop when it gets to the point there. So that's one aspect of the data. And I sort of had more fun with that because of all the stochastic differential equation stuff that was involved. Here's another aspect going along with the motion of the seal. So what we have here are 6 successive days worth of data. This is the seal starting off from Santa Barbara, and it's in a shallow and so on. At the beginning, it's not diving too deeply. These are 24-hour stretches of the data going along here. And you see how amazingly regular these things are. And I guess one can picture that the animal is finding some good stuff to eat. So it goes down, and it's pretty good, and it goes back down to that same place. So it sort of dives and comes up for a bit and dives again. But every so often it gets it's doing some different things. Like here, it was resting on the surface for quite a while. Here's a succession of sort of short dives. I guess it was finding what it was looking for without having to go too deeply, and so on. So basically, what this data is then, it's coming from the time depth recorder. The measurements are being made every 30 seconds, so one's having an estimate of the depth every 30 seconds. In the case of the navigation data, those were simply every 24 hours. Those were the midday positions going along with the seal. So there's some questions that one can put to time depth data. So, for example, one can ask, is there some 24-hour period present in the data? What can one say about the shapes of the various dives? Are the different dives in some fashion intercorrelated? I guess I gave a motivation a moment ago that would lead you to ask that question, that they found fish, squid, or whatever at a particular location, so they were going back there again, so that would suggest they were intercorrelated. For the analysis I'm going to present in just a second, there were 215,000 data points, and the animal made 4,400 dives or so. And this is the figures I gave you before. So the data sets are pretty big, and you can see how these poor marine biologists were a bit intimidated with dealing with that. So now I'm going to focus on on the question of whether there's a circadian rhythm, and then I'll turn to the question of the shapes of the individual dive. So circadian rhythm refers to a biological phenomenon that has period around 24 hours. And so I've got this massive amount of data, and you saw how sort of irregular that data was. I mean, it was sort of regular in the sense they're making about three dives every hour, but in terms of whether there's a 24-hour frequency present, that was very hard to see just by looking at the data. So a very convenient way to grab onto that sort of question is to just see how correlated is the data, the y of t here, with a cosine function of period 24 hours and with a sine function of 24 hours. So you can picture computing both of those things and then looking at the sum of the squares, the modulus, the size of these two things here. And that's a traditional statistic going back to the late 1800s, really. It's called the periodogram. And before I take this away, I'll just mention some other questions that come up are whether the dives are clustered. That's intercorrelated. And then you can ask whether there seems to be 1 over F noise present. Let me point out a Z to the people in the audience. See, I remembered this time. Okay, so what we have here is a graph of the size of the sum of the squares of those two correlations and so on. And if there's a phenomenon present of a particular frequency, that will show up in that the value is large. So here is the part of that graph for low frequencies, periods corresponding to frequencies of up to 2.5 cycles per day. Well, sure enough, we find this nice peak here, right opposite frequency of 1 cycle per day. And here we're finding the harmonic going along with that. You're going to find harmonics are present when the shape of the phenomenon's repeating isn't a pure sine wave. And so this graph, I think, pulls out very nicely that there is really a very strong 24-hour period that is present. Okay, now let's move to some higher frequencies. So this part of the graph here, that's really just this part from here over. Now I've switched to putting the frequencies on a log scale in order to pull things together. So we even see a third harmonic appearing in the analysis. Okay, what's going on over here is these peaks are corresponding to the fact that the seal is diving about 3 times an hour, sort of the regularity that the seal is showing. And this is the harmonic going along with that, but it's not like the 24-hour cycle. It's something that shifts because the seal rests for longer periods up at the surface and so on. The fact that we have these values here, which correspond to very low frequencies, that they're high, well, that's suggesting there is some sort of slow movement present. Some very long frequencies are present, and so that's evidence of clustering taking place. And then people who sort of, there's a whole field concerned with 1 over F noise, which is basically looking to see whether or not when you compute a graph of this sort, the points seem to fall near a straight line on, 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 on the graph there. And people are concerned with 1 over F noise because it has nice scaling properties. It goes along with fractiles and so on. And so here we seem to have some evidence of that phenomenon being present. Okay, my next analysis really refers to trying to learn a bit about the shapes of these dives. You can picture that the animal has different types of dives to use in different situations. It could be an exploratory dive, just looking for food. It could be a dive that he's found the food and then he's going back looking, she's going back looking for more food. It could be a dive going along with sleeping. I mean, they have no idea, for example, if these animals even sleep and so on. And it could well be that some of these dives are just the metabolism and so on is slowed way down and they're basically sleeping. So what I've shown here is just the first 10 dives of that sequence of like 4,400 dives, and one can be concerned with whether or not there are some particular shapes of dives that are turning up more commonly here. So I was saying at the beginning how one of the important tools of the statistician is to create a stochastic model going along with the circumstance. So here's one that seems of interest for this particular situation. So first off, the data is a time series, this long time series, 200,000 data points. Well, to study the dives, I actually broke it up into the individual dives. It was pretty easy to see when the seal had died. The start of the dives was pretty clear. So basically now, I let U be a time variable that just refers to the time the seal has spent so far in the dive. So this notation here, this is the depth of the seal, U times after it has started the case dive. So the model is that this measurement is made up of a randomly selected dive shape. So cap I here is indexing the number of shapes of dives that we have. And in a moment, I'll show you some of these. And little k is indexing how many dives there are. And I have in mind a model that says the probability that the seal is using the ith type dive is pi sub I. And so the goal is to end up with some estimates of these particular quantities here. And then for an example, a route into studying the clustering, if there's some present, the intercorrelation of the individual dyes, would be a series that's basically the category of our estimate of the category of a particular dive at time k, where k is indexing the particular dive there. So not because I knew that Professor Karp was going to talk about a situation with four symbols, sequences of four different symbols taking place, but because that just was the way I checked out my computer program the first time, I supposed that there were four different categories of dyes. And I fit this model here using what's called the method of maximum likelihood, and so I ended up with these four different dives here. You see this is a very lengthy dive. Here is sort of a shallow, sort of searching dive, perhaps. Here is a shorter, deep one. And here is a not-so-deep, not-so-long dive. Underneath, I have estimates of the proportions going along with these different dive types. So this was the rarest and so on. This was the most common. And I don't have a graph of it, but the thing I'm working on now is I have these sequences then of the different, of an estimate of what type of dive the seal is involved in. So that corresponds to the letters of the DNA sequences, for example, and one's looking for intercorrelations amongst these things, trying to understand the temporal dependence. Okay, now statisticians have lots of fun making trouble for people, sort of saying, well, you think you've learned something, but you haven't learned anything. And that goes along with the idea of difficulties of interpretation of the results of analysis. And I just want to sort of end up with a couple examples of the difficulties of interpretation. So the data is the depth recorded every 30 seconds. So what I've done here is I've drawn a continuous curve that might actually represent what the seal was doing, but the zeros the circles on the graph here refer to the times at which we've made measurements. Now, the sort of thing one would like to do would be to estimate the vertical velocity with which the seal is moving. But the problem is we only have sampled values here, and the seal could be very active in between these points. So that's a difficulty of interpretation one has to remember. But in fact, it's a lot more difficult in this particular case because really the seal is moving around in three dimensions. So you could have the seal sort of, this is meant to represent the surface up here, slowly going round and, I mean, going down at a certain rate, but swimming in incredibly rapidly to sort of be going down at a certain apparent vertical velocity. Or the seal could be moving not quite so rapidly, going round and round. Here, it's starting to move not too rapidly at all. And then basically, in this picture, the seal is going straight down. So in terms of trying to take this time depth data and infer what it might correspond to in the seal's behavior, one has to remember that there are these tremendous limitations going along with the data here. And so the marine biologists certainly know this, and what they've been trying to do is to put some sort of velocity indicator to make it part of this sensor, some sort of paddle that would go round and round, but they're having a lot of trouble getting that working. So there seem to always be difficulties of interpretation with data. Okay, so just a bit of discussion here. So what did we learn? Well, that the great circle certainly seems to be plausible. There seems to be a 24-hour behavior that's present, and the sort of thing we're doing now are techniques to see how that is slowly changing in time. There seems to be some apparent regularity in the dives. There seem to be these different types that are present. Remains. Well, these are the questions I put to Brent. What are you guys really trying to learn out of all this? Well, how they navigate, why they migrate, how do they sleep? They just have a whole host of questions, and I guess they're hoping that making these measurements is going to give them some clues as answers to the questions. Roles of statistics in the problem. Well, I've been summarizing up the data. It's partly been a descriptive statistic exercise. I've been estimating parameters going along with models. Another important contribution statistics makes to science generally is we have tools for assessing the goodness of fit for a particular model to a situation. And we have models to try to apply, and very easily, we often find ourselves studying models that people haven't investigated before, as in this case, this stochastic differential equation corresponding to diffusion with a drift on the sphere. Some of the tools that we worked with, well, I was saying how I viewed my job is what my work is involving equal amounts of material from the substance of science and equal parts mathematics, so in this case, marine biology. I guess part of my talk here maybe is a bit devious for the mathematicians in the audience, because I'm sort of trying to show that statisticians have more fun. Being good at mathematics, just that means you can be a really good statistician, I would say. And the thing is also one of the joys we statisticians have is I don't think there's any field or subject in existence we can't stick our nose into and make some trouble for people and have some fun out of it. Because just think how often nowadays, things are put in the computer. One of my students is doing a thesis on studying music. And he has whole symphonies in the computer and so on, studying these things as time series. So when someone comes to me and says they'd like to do a thesis with me, I will invariably say, well, what are you interested in? And this guy said he was interested in music. So there was no problem getting something going there at all. Okay, some of the tools employed, time series, that's sort of the area I work in a lot, stochastic differential equations, and here I mentioned the important statistical package that people use a lot nowadays. Now, nearly all of modern science, it's it seems to be the case that you can't do things alone, and it's just crucial to be collaborating with other people. And my collaborator is Brent Stewart from Hub SeaWorld down at San Diego.
Thank you very much.
Okay, yes, and I want to do that. Now, the problem with this data set I focused on here is the locations are every 24 hours. Okay, so picture the dives are going on. We got data every 30 seconds. Now, I do have some data taken for some seals in a lake in Alaska where the seal had a radio transmitter on it. This is a ring seal. And there's an array of antennas. So they were actually able to locate where the seal was going. As a function of time in 3D, and there's some data on a couple of seals, and you can sort of start asking: are they moving independently? Are they interacting? Are they repelling each other? And so on. So I haven't had the quality data to really make it worthwhile to study that, but that's coming. I mean, they're just getting these sensors are getting better and better. And see, for the location, they also have some sensors that do have radio signals attached to them. And so when the satellites are going by, if the seal's up on the surface, they can be getting an estimate of the location of the seal then. So that would be more often than every 24 hours. But you see how, I mean, it's easy to be a mathematician and look for a little while and find some wonderful problem no one has worked on, and then you've got a problem to work on. Maybe that's one difference with the statisticians. I mean, we're expected to answer the first question that came along, rather than what was the quote of Professor Coleman for studying delights or something like that. Yeah.
In estimating latitude and longitude, mm-hmm. time of sunrise and sunset, yeah. Given that they dive, they're underwater for 20 to 30 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. What if they're underwater when the sun comes up?
Well, so that's the inaccuracy that would be involved. Yeah, so there's some sort of smoothing going on and so on. So no, that's definitely there. Yeah.
This was following the female.
Yeah, that seal, the great circle, is
there.
Calves? Now something else that's absolutely fascinating. I didn't think to say. I think it was on one of the transparencies. Is these animals are not like whales. It's not as if the female has the calf and then the whole family heads north after that. They go quite independently. The female just abandons the calf after 3 or 4 weeks. And so they really are out there all by themselves, as far as anyone knows. So really how they know to get there and how they know to get back, it's a tremendous mystery. You know, they talk about magnetic fields. They talk about polarized light. And things like that they're using like that. I mean, my favorite would be they're like the Polynesians. They're looking at the stars and seeing where to go. But you can sort of see they know where they're going in some sense, because if you look at the tracks on the way back, they're really accelerating when they're heading for the last couple of days of the journey. Now, I don't know whether that's just the breeding season or molting season. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if they somehow know how to go straight ahead, you know, they're following the geodesic and so on. But why doesn't the ship captain or the airplane captain do that? You know, they're sort of using their compass all the time and having to change course. So,
correct.
That's right, yeah.
If they just want to follow the great circle, then they just let the ship go.
Yeah, well... obviously it's the efficient way to go when you want to get between two places to follow that thing. But they somehow get distracted by finding the fish and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any influence of the Coriolis effect? Have you taken that into account?
I've certainly not taken that into account. I certainly learned about it at Esquimalt, but I think the errors, like the time of sunrise and sunset, are probably such that that's not going to... It's not going to show itself. But I don't know. Oh, you're the chairman, so yeah. I guess when you want to ask a question, you get to ask it.
David, if you get that wind stress data, you might be able to know how much they're being affected.
Francis Wires, by the way, he wrote some papers on modeling the tracks of icebergs. So that's another sort of trajectory there. And you certainly were using physical models to try to describe that motion.
Is there any data on following the same path twice?
I don't know. That's the sort of thing we're all organized to try, but I haven't had time yet. And it would be, there's data for the same animal on successive years, so it wouldn't just be the two migrations, but it could be the successive years.
How are they estimating the population?
Oh, they do it from the birth rate.
That's how they've been doing it the last years. Now, when I said that maybe there were 60 to 80 left, well, that's just a guess that the marine biologists made way back when. But basically now they are trying to infer it from the birth rate going along with it. Yeah.
He said fusions with drift boats. Were there specific mathematical questions that arose if you had?
Well, yeah, I want to estimate the parameters. You know, there are unknown parameters there. Yeah, that's the sort of thing I've been doing, and the expected travel time and so on. Yeah, you probably know Kendall's paper on holes. Seeking bird navigation. So that's the question on the plane and also over short distances. So the thing that was fun for me was having to actually include the sines and cosines in the model. Yeah?
If they mold, how do you know
you've
got the same field the next year?
Well, I guess they're, I don't know. You need Brent here, I will say. I don't know. But, I mean, they these guys sort of love these animals, so maybe they can recognize them by some other characteristic. If you give me your email address, I'll have Brent send you an answer.
David, how are the sensors recovered?
They wait till the guy goes to sleep. Okay, so he comes back, and now it's quite fascinating what's happened with Brent. He was so frustrated with the U.S. government because he needs to get permission to go to these islands to recover these things that he went to law school. So he's been at Berkeley the last 2.5 years getting a law degree. It's like to cope in modern society, apparently you need a law degree. So he goes out and there's sort of like a 2 or 3 week period within which he has to recover these things. Now, there's a radio transmitter on these that's not very strong power, so they can actually locate the animal. Sometimes they find that the transmitter is 6 inches deep in the sand because they've lost it. But basically, they find the animal, they wait till it goes to sleep, they sedate it some more, and they just unclamp it.
There's nothing self-selecting about the ones that they're
using. You're talking to a statistician. I said to him, well, how do you pick the particular seals that you use? And he just sort of shrugged his shoulders. he looked for healthy ones, is what he said.
Well, if you can just bear with me for 1 or 2 minutes, I know it's been a long afternoon, but I would also really like to thank the speakers. I think they've shown us what breadth mathematics has and how much fun it can be, too. And this is really what we want to do with the Pacific Institute, to come out of the closet, come out of the ivory tower. Did I say closet? Yeah. Well, the ivory tower is also kind of a closet, right, where we have been a long time. But I would also like to thank some other people here. I would like to thank the colleagues who have taken care of the speakers over the last couple of days, because I have been too busy myself, and Mary Lesperance, Florin Diaku, and Valerie King have taken care of our speakers. I would also like to thank the chairman of this afternoon. You may have wondered why we picked these chairmen. And I mean, this was not a coincidence, right? Because when Kelly and I put this program together for the afternoon, I said I would like the people who have done the most work for the Pacific Institute to get some exposure today. And I mean, there are many, many people who have worked literally hundreds of hours to get this Pacific Institute going. And it's in motion now, but it's not yet flying. it will hopefully fly. But nobody has done more, and I think that's fair to say, than the people who have been the chairman today, Arvind Gupta, Ed Perkins, and Jonathan Borwein. And I wanted to put them out here so you could see them. If you can imagine people who have donated a year of their lives towards a cause, you've seen them. And I know I'm not exaggerating, because they tried to get me to do the same, and I fought. Finally, I would like to thank all of you for showing up today, and I hope we will see you all many times over for more activities of the Pacific Institute. Thank you. Oh, Ed.
Bus pickup, is Thomas here to tell us where the bus will come?
Oh. Okay, the bus will pick us up in front of the Commons Club, 7:45, for those of you going to the UCNS.
The Commons Block is where the reception is.
That's right. Actually, if you want to go there by yourself, you go due east, past the library. great circle, and then you walk. Eventually, you will see a concrete bridge leading.